All right, we are officially recording. And as everybody is funneling in here, I think everybody's getting my emails, hopefully, that you're still, and I'm not sending out a whole ton of emails, but a couple, that are reminding you about when class times are. I sent out an email the other day to let you know that office hours were live, and a couple of people jumped into office hours, so that was great, and I will keep doing that, I think. So when office hours are happening, I'll send out an email just to remind you that, hey, it's office hours, and jump in at any point for help. So that was working the other day. And also the new website that I've got, chemed.study, and I'm updating. I'm not seeing this on no, it's not on Canvas yet, Caden. I'm still fumbling with the Canvas thing. I hate Canvas. Ah, it's killing me. I'm still going to try and get that up and running. But the problem is the structure of it doesn't fit with my brain. And I keep trying to create content and flow of content through Canvas. And I've looked at a couple of Canvas sites now that look pretty good. And I think I'm just going to try and model after those and see if I can't throw the pages in that I need to throw in there. So anyway, I'm feeling good about a few things. My daughter is home from Washington State. And she was up at Western Washington University, and she's taking a math class online. She's taking three classes online this quarter, and her math class and all her classes just suck online. Her instructors can't figure out how to use the technology, and they're writing on paper, and they have a camera that sort of like looks down at the paper, but she can't see what the instructor is writing on the paper half the time. And it's just horrible, apparently. So she keeps coming in and she's just absolutely dying in there while I'm in here giving my own lectures and trying to make this thing work and have it come out right. So I hope it's working for you guys, and we'll keep it going. So anyway, all of the new stuff, I put out the email, all of the new videos and audio recordings and note recordings are going to go up at chemed.study instead of being on the Cabrillo site. So no more on the Cabrillo site. It's all going to be at chemed.study. And that's where all the new postings are going to go. And it is the exact same website that I had at Cabrillo. I just moved everything over, migrated it all over. And so everything is in its exact same place. Everything looks the same. It looks as if you're at the Cabrillo site. It's just new at chemed.study. And that was a web address, chemed.study, that I spent some time thinking about trying to figure out what would be a good website for a chemistry class. And that was my domain name, chemed.study. So I had to pay a little extra for the .study, but it seemed like it was a good name and you guys could find it, could remember it pretty easy, chemed.study. So, okay, let's pick up with class. Unless you guys have any questions, I always like to start with questions first. Maybe you have questions on what we did last time, or kind of how things are working. I want to check in and make sure everybody's doing okay and see if there's anything I can help you with before we jump into lecture here. Give you a second to think about any questions you might have. It's always, how long do I wait? How long do I fill? How long do I keep talking while you think about questions? Everybody seems like they're pretty good. All right, if everybody's good, then let's go ahead and jump in. And we're going to start off today with optical activity. So we did configurations last time, R and S. And as we looked at R and S were man-made configurations. And let's see, how do we want to start this off? So last time, little recap. Last time we did configurations. And that was R and S. And that was a clockwise orientation for R, a counterclockwise orientation for S, in terms of priorities and based on the Kahn-Ingold-Prelog rules. And it's a man-made system. It doesn't have any reality in the way that a molecule reacts. It doesn't have anything to do with the way that it reacts with being polarized light. A boiling points, melting points, polarity, doesn't have any of that. It is just a classification system that is a completely man-made bookkeeping system that allows us to be able to distinguish between two isomers or two stereocenters, be them R or S. So that's what we did last time. Today, it's all about optical activity, or at least we'll start with optical activity. We may transition into some other things. And this is optical activity is how a molecule reacts with plane polarized light. So this is a physical property. Optical activity differs in that this is a physical property. It's how the molecule reacts with plane polarized light. And I know that we discussed this in that there were differences. And I think we even discussed the fact that why it rotates plane polarized light, so that we looked at the fact that the molecule has different optical densities as you go around clockwise versus counterclockwise, and that those different optical densities can either slow down the light or speed up the light, such that the light plane will rotate. And the experiment that we did there, just to remind too, is that we took a light bulb, and that light bulb was a sodium D lamp. So we have a little filament in there. And that light that comes out of that is of all different orientations. So you can think about these as light vectors that come out that are oriented in 360 degrees. And that light goes through a filter. So we'll make that filter here. And that filter has very tiny slits in it. And the slits are so tight and oriented perfectly vertically that the light that comes through now gets polarized. So this is a polarizing filter. And you can get a sense of this if you have a pair of sunglasses handy. Your computer screen is generally polarized. And if you take the sunglasses and you hold them out in front of your face and you rotate them, what you'll see is that the computer screen will get dark. And if you keep rotating around in a circle, you'll see the computer screen get light again. The polarizing filters on the sunglasses are cutting the light from the polarized light from your computer screen. So your computer screen you can think of as being vertical, and as you rotate the sunglasses, what happens is the filter no longer aligns with the light such that the slits in the sunglasses are this way and they block all the light, so the screen goes dark. And as you rotate around again, it comes back into light again. That's essentially what the polarizing filter is doing. We then pass this through a sample chamber. So we've got a little sample chamber of specific length, and the compound is sitting inside this sample chamber, and it's filled up so that there's no air bubbles in here. And the light passes through this, and as the light passes through this, it comes out, and it will, if this is a single isomer, single enantiomer, then what will happen is the light will adjust from its original orientation to a new orientation, and it will rotate through some angle, and that angle we will call alpha. And we will detect that angle by using another lens. So we take another lens here, and what we do is we look through this lens, and this lens we rotate. So there's a little thing up here that says zero, and it has a dial around it that can measure angles in different directions. And essentially what we do is we rotate it until the light maximizes, until the light becomes its brightest. And when the light becomes its brightest that we're seeing through there, once we align that filter, let me look at it doing this way. We align the filter with the light that's coming through, so we maximize the brightness, and the arrow will point to the angle alpha as it comes through, so that we can tell what that angle actually is and how far the light has been rotated. And that is called a polarimeter. And so the polarimeter is actually a fairly simple device. It's two polarizing lenses, one that can rotate and has a scale on it, one that is fixed, a light source, and a sample chamber. And it's a pretty simple little device, but allows us to very accurately measure optical activity and rotation that chiral compounds do. Okay, and so all compounds that are chiral, that are single isomers, will rotate plane polarized light. And because the concentrations can be different, usually we don't do these in a neat solution, we have what's called the specific rotation. Specific rotation is, let me think if I can think of an analogy of what specific rotation is. If there's another thing that you've done in chemistry, I can't think of one, and maybe it'll come to me in a little bit. Let me give you the definition of what specific rotation is. Specific rotation has a symbol, alpha, in square brackets. It has a temperature, and it has a small d in the lowercase, in the subscript. And this is equal to alpha divided by concentration and path length. So here's what each of these symbols are. Alpha is the observed rotation. The observed rotation is what we observed up here in this experiment. So when we went through and we looked at this, this is the observed rotation. So that's the alpha symbol that we're using there. C is concentration. And the concentration is in grams per milliliter. So it's not concentration in moles per liter, it's in grams per milliliter. L is the path length. The path length is the length that is here on the sample chamber. That's the path length. Path length is measured in decimeters. So it's a tenth of a meter. So we're measuring it in tenths of meters rather than in centimeters, which would be hundredths of meters. So we're measuring in tenths of meters. All of these units come about because this was originally done on sugars and was more biological in nature. And so some of the units are more biology type units of concentration and path length and things rather than what would have been clear just chemistry units. So a lot of them are more biological in nature. The D that is being used in the subscript, this is the sodium D line. And it's a specific wavelength of light such that if you change the wavelength of light, that's 589 nanometers. If you change the wavelength in light, then you need to report that in the specific rotation because it changes the actual rotation. So almost all of these are done in using the sodium D line. The historical reason on using the sodium D line is that it was a monochromatic light source. And there were very few monochromatic light sources in history before we hit the 1900s. And the sodium D line was one that was a monochromatic light source that made it very easy for everybody to access and use. So that's why they used it. It was that monochromatic light source. And the temperature is measured in degrees Celsius. And the specific rotation is dependent on all of these things. So what it's doing is it's taking an observed rotation and taking concentration out of the observed rotation. That's what it's doing. It's also taking path length out of the observed rotation and calculating the specific rotation, which is independent of path length and independent of concentration. So that's what all of these things are. Just to give you an example, so what we can do is we can take a compound such as limonene. Limonene is a terpene. Terpenes are 10 carbon molecules that come from a number of different natural product sources. And those terpenes, this is R, the stereocenter is here. This is R, and it is plus limonene. So limonene comes from a number of different sources. the main one being mandarins and oranges and citrus fruit like that. That's where limonene comes from and has that particular odor to it of citrus. And let's say that we have 100 milliliters and this is of 12.3 grams of limonene. So this is our concentration, is equal to 100 milliliters, 12.3 grams. We're going to do this at 20 degrees C. And we're going to do it in a 10 centimeter tube, but we'll have to convert that into decimeters. So that equals one decimeter. And we're doing this at the sodium D line. And the rotation that we observe when we do the experiment comes out to 15.60 degrees of rotation. So calculating out what the specific rotation is, the way that we do that is we just throw all of these values into our calculation. We're doing this at 20 degrees C at the sodium D line. This equals 15.60 degrees divided by one decimeter times the 12.30 grams divided by 100 milliliters, because it is grams per milliliter that we want to do. When this comes out, we get 126.8 degrees, and that is milliliters over decimeters, grams. And the way that we report it is that the concentration is 0.123, and that this solvent is hexane. So this was a hexane solvent that we did this computation in, and we would report that specific concentration. Oops, come on. There we go. Just wanted to get it a little bit more centered in the screen. We would report that specific rotation as 126.8 degrees. And normally what we do is we don't put all the units on it. We just normally say that the specific rotation, alpha 20D, is equal to 126.8, and we just leave it degrees. The rest of the units are there, but because it's an optical rotation, we generally just leave it at 126 and we don't put the milliliters per decimeter per gram. Although we do frequently list the concentration because we want to know what concentration it was done at originally and what solvent it was obtained in, so that we have all of the required information to go back and reproduce that if we needed to. All right, so that's just an example of how we would go through. And then, because we now know that the limonene, we know, let me redraw the limonene down here. Because now we know its configuration in the name, so we have the R, and we have its optical rotation, the plus, we say that we know now the absolute configuration. So this piece is the configuration. This is the sign of rotation. And that's a plane polarized light, so the sign of rotation of light. Those two things, when you know them combined, we say that we know the absolute configuration. Because we have figured out that the positive rotation goes with R, and that a negative rotation then would go with S. And so if we looked at its enantiomer would have the stereochemical group back. So we draw its mirror image. If we're flipping it that way, then we draw this, and this one would be S, and this one would be the minus enantiomer, rotating light the opposite direction, limonene. There we go. So that would be the S minus limonene. And remember what we said was that configuration R or S does not go with a particular sign of rotation in the way that it rotates plane polarized light. That needs to be experimentally determined. R can rotate light positive or negative. It doesn't matter. It's not a factor. R does not determine which way light rotates. So in order to know both, we need to measure both. And if you think about that, that's kind of unique. Because how do you know which isomer you have in the flask? How do you know whether you have the R or the S? You can't just look at a molecule and know whether or not, you can't see the molecule, you can't see the stereocenter. So we don't know whether we have the R or the S. And the sign of rotation is easy. You just put the single isomer into the instrument and measure its rotation. But we don't know whether we have the R or the S, and we need to do more work to be able to figure that out. Mattias, how does optical activity change the behavior of a species? Why is it important? The optical activity is a means for us to know whether or not we have a pure sample or not. So here's part of the thing. How do we know, what is our measure? Let's do it this way. What is our measure of purity? Really what we're saying is, how do we know we have a pure sample? And this is not for optical isomers, this is just a pure sample in general. The answer to that is several different things. We have boiling points or melting points. That the more narrow the melting point is, the more pure the sample is. So melting points, boiling points can help us determine whether or not we have a pure sample. The other thing that can help us is chromatography. So you can think about either TLC or a column or GC. All of these things can help us decide whether or not we have a single compound in, or there's a mixture of compounds, so we can see when there are multiple compounds in there. We can also look at spectroscopy. And I know we haven't done spectroscopy yet, but within spectroscopy, we could look at IR or NMR or mass spec. And here's the thing. All of these ways of telling whether or not we have a pure sample work on regular molecules, because regular molecules have differences in their boiling points, in their melting points, in their polarities, in their spectroscopy, but enantiomers have all these things the same. So for regular compounds, these all work for regular compounds. But enantiomers, all these factors are the same. They have the same boiling point and melting point. So you can't use that. They have the same polarity, which means that chromatography is out. So chromatography is out. So melting point and boiling point are out. Spectroscopy is the same. They have the same structure. Same atom connectivity. So the atom connectivity is the same. So spectroscopy is out. So the only thing that we can do, the only tool that we have to assess purity of optical isomers is optical activity. That leaves only optical activity. And the big picture in that is something like thalidomide, like a drug that was, let me get the picture of thalidomide. I'm going to take a second and there we go. I couldn't remember the structure off the top of my head, but now I can draw it for you. So thalidomide looks like this. And there are many drugs like thalidomide on the market that that cannot be sold as a mixture. They must be pure. Otherwise, they cause bad side effects. So this is the R enantiomer of thalidomide. So this is the stereocenter, and this is R thalidomide. And the question is, if we want to give thalidomide as a medication, then we need to have a way to be able to assess the purity of the material such that we know that we only have one isomer. Francisco, could you use X-ray crystallography? Yes and no. X-ray crystallography could theoretically tell you which isomer you have, but there's a special way that they do it. When you look at the three-dimensional nature and what X-ray crystallography does, X-ray crystallography takes a solid matrix and you fire X-rays at it, and the X-rays diffract off the nuclei. So when we see nuclei, then the X-rays will diffract off the nuclei, and you can build back the three-dimensional nature of where the particles are. X-ray crystallography has a resolution that is down around 3 angstroms, maybe a little bit better than 3 angstroms, depending upon the resolution. So usually it's somewhere between 10 angstroms and on down to maybe, I don't even know if you can do it down to 1 angstrom. But the problem is that with an X-ray crystallography, you can't tell the difference between stereocenters unless you put heavy nuclei embedded in the crystal structure. Heavy nuclei being a heavy metal. So we put in a very heavy metal in there and we dope the crystal structure. And then that gives us spatial resolution, forwards and backwards. Otherwise, if you just have the crystal structure itself, you lose the spatial resolution and you can't tell whether a molecule is oriented one way or another way in the X-ray crystallography. So it takes a special type of X-ray crystallography in order to be able to resolve enantiomers and tell what the stereocenters are. And it's extremely difficult to do. It's not an easy thing. So that's a great question. And the answer is yes and no. And sometimes, not all the time. So good question. All right, so that's a little bit why this is important. It's important because we need to be able to tell whether or not a sample is pure or not. And it's not just for medications. It's our only way of assessing purity. It is not, there's no other good way that is fast and easy. Also, Francisco, X-ray crystallography, in order to do it, you have to get a crystal of the material. If the material won't crystallize, you can't take the crystallography of it. So you can't get the three-dimensional nature. And for many small molecules, that's not easy. For big molecules, it's really not easy. The other factor is that you have to dope it. And so you've got to get the crystal and you got to get a dope crystal. And an X-ray crystallography instrument is expensive. And you've got to do this in really cold temperatures at liquid nitrogen freezing temperatures in order to keep the movement in the crystal small enough to be able to actually measure it. Whereas optical activity can be done simply on a benchtop, super easy, just with a little instrument that looks like a telescope, except you're looking through it. It's kind of like a cross between a telescope looking thing and a microscope looking thing. And all you're looking at is light and measuring the light, and it's super easy and inexpensive as can be. So that's why we use this. Okay. But one of the questions I have for you is, let's look at this instrument and look at what I did before. So I'm going to go back up and look at the instrument. All right. In looking at this instrument, and I'm going to change my notes a little bit. So I'm going to delete a couple of arrows. One of the questions I have is, in looking at this, there's two possible options. One option, I'll do it in blue, is that the light rotated clockwise to give this orientation. The other possibility is that the light did not rotate clockwise, but the light rotated counterclockwise. And so the question is, which direction did the light go? Did the light go counterclockwise? Or did the light go clockwise? And when you first do the experiment, and it's an unknown compound, and you've never seen the compound before, you don't know whether the light went clockwise or counterclockwise. Finn thinks it went clockwise. Why do you think it went clockwise, Finn? You want to unmute your mic and tell me why you think it went clockwise?
Because that's the way you kind of drew it, isn't it?
Ah, yes, I did. But that's why I'm going back and I'm redrawing it and saying light could have gone either direction. We don't know whether the light went clockwise or counterclockwise. There's no way. Well, there is a way. We're going to talk about the way. Colin wants to go, went counterclockwise. The question or the answer is that we don't know until we do an experiment to figure out whether the light went clockwise or counterclockwise. That when you just measure one optical activity, you have no way of knowing. But let's think about this experiment. Let's take and, so let's make sure that our notes are representing what we want here. The question is, what if the molecule is new? This is something that has never been seen before. It's a new molecule, you just made it. Never before seen, never before measured. And you're measuring it for the first time. And how do we know? If the rotation is plus or minus, that's what we want to know. Okay, so let's consider that we measure this molecule. So this is our molecule. And the star is just saying that this is a single isomer. And that we do 23.2 grams in 100 milliliters of methanol. So that's our concentration. We're at 20 degrees C. And we're in a 1 decimeter tube, really common to use a 1 decimeter tube, although they can be longer. And that our observed rotation is either 32 degrees or it could be minus 328 degrees. So when we measure it for the first time, it could be either one of these and we don't know which one is true. So basically what we're saying is that when we look at our dial, that our dial is giving me a 32 degree, where is that? It's going to be 90. Let's take 32 here. Our rotation is telling me that from zero, it went this direction, 32 degrees on the positive scale, or it went around the other direction and came around to here, which was our minus 328 degrees. Okay, and we don't know which one of these is correct. So let's consider this. Consider running the scan again. The polarimeter. Again. Cutting the concentration in half. So now what we're going to do is instead of running 23.2 grams in 100 milliliters, we're going to cut that 23.2 grams in half, or we'll just increase the concentration to 200 milliliters. So we'll take 23.2 grams in 200 milliliters. And everything else is the same. So we keep the 1 decimeter tube, the 20 degrees Celsius, all that stuff stays the same. Okay, so what happens when we cut the concentration in half? Let's go back to the specific rotation alpha, which is going to equal temperature and D, and this is going to equal our alpha over the concentration times the path length. So what happens is, if I cut the concentration in half, then because the concentration is in the denominator, it is going to increase our specific rotation. Actually, I don't want to say it that way. How do I want to say this? Let's do it this way. This is where I always make the mistake, and I'm not going to make the mistake this time. I'm not going to do it, people. I'm going to do this right. Equals alpha times now 1/2 C times L. And these two, this is the mistake I always make, these two have to be equal to each other. They have to be the same. The specific rotation cannot change for the molecule. So what is going to change is the observed rotation. The observed rotation is what's going to change. Actually, I only need to highlight that once. Okay, so what's going to happen is, if I take and say alpha 1 over 1/2 C times the path length is equal to alpha 2 over C times the path length. I guess I should have done this way. I got my ones and twos messed up. 2, 1, that was the first one that we did, and the path length. And so I cut the concentration in half. What I can do is I can get rid of now path length, because it's the same. C is the same. And what that means is, mathematically, that alpha 2 over 1/2 is going to equal alpha 1, or 2 times alpha 2 is going to equal alpha 1. Basically, when I cut the concentration in half, what's going to happen is that the alpha 2 is going to equal 1/2 alpha 1. The measured optical rotation is going to cut in half. And so two possibilities now arise. The two possibilities are, if rotation was positive, then what's going to happen is, on my measured rotation, remember my rotation was 32 degrees if it was positive. That is not a good circle. Come on, Jason, you can do a circle. There we go. So the original rotation was here at 32 degrees. This was alpha 1. If it was a positive rotation, then what will happen is the rotation for alpha 2 will be here at, was it 17 degrees? No, 16 degrees. So this will be alpha 2. If the rotation was negative, then what's going to happen is, we'll copy this whole thing, paste it over. We're in business. So now we need to adjust. And we said it was minus 300 and, what was it? Minus 328. So the first rotation would have been all the way this way to minus 328. And that would have been our alpha 1. The rotation will cut in half as we go through and do it. And alpha 2 would then be here. And so rotation will go this direction. This will be alpha 2. And it will be 1/2 of 328. What's 1/2 of 328? That's 150 plus 14, 164. So it'll be 164 degrees minus 164 degrees if the rotation was negative. So by cutting the concentration in half, if the concentration of the measured rotation goes to 16 degrees, then I know it was a positive rotation. If the rotation goes to minus 164, then I know that it was a negative rotation. I think I was fairly clear in that. I was not as clear in my words as I was in my writing. Let me ask if that made sense in terms of how I went through there. Matt's got it. Colin's got it. Mattis has got it. Okay. I'm going by the thumbs up that I'm doing okay here and making sense. Excellent. Okay. I always feel like I need to do that check-in real quick, especially when I botch the language and I want to make sure that we're okay. All right. So that's where the math comes from. And the important part there is that the specific rotation has to be the same. That's locked in because the specific rotation is by definition for the compound independent of concentration and independent of rotation. So if I cut the concentration in half, the optical rotation, the specific rotation has to be the same, which means that my observed rotations will change and I can tell whether or not the rotation is positive or negative. So the first time you do one of these and you've never done it before for a particular compound, you have to do it twice in order to figure out whether the rotation is actually positive or negative. And that's in practice how they do it. So that's how we know whether or not rotation is positive or negative. Okay, so what I need to do then is to talk about, now that we've talked about measuring optical rotations, we can talk about purity of mixtures. And purity of mixtures is defined as enantiomeric excess. So enantiomeric excess, we have some terms that I need to hit first. The terms that we need to hit is single isomer. A single isomer is said to be enantiomerically pure. This is also said to be optically pure. So those are the terms that we use, enantiomerically pure or optically pure. Those are referring to a single isomer. Finn, can we practice one? Finn, I'd have to make up numbers and I could do that, but on the fly in a lecture, that's gonna take me time. Maybe what I could do is we could do one at the end of class or something. We can go back and I could try and make up numbers. I just don't want to stall the video and the information for me to sit here and pull out a calculator and make up a bunch of numbers and then come up with one. But yeah, I hear you. You want to practice it. Let me get that later. So hang on to that. Okay, a 50-50 mixture in terms of enantiomeric excess. A 50-50 mixture of isomers is said to be racemic. It is a non-optically active mixture. By that I mean it will not rotate plane polarized light. The mixture will not rotate light. Observed alpha will equal 0 degrees. And that's because you have both isomers. You have the plus isomer and you have the negative isomer in equal amounts. So in the clockwise rotation and in the counterclockwise rotation, they're canceling each other out. And there's no observed rotation in that case. And then non-racemic. Non-racemic means a couple of different things. Non-racemic means that it is an unequal mixture, that there is an enantiomeric excess. We have an excess of one isomer over the other. And these are usually written as percent EE, meaning percent enantiomeric excess. This is how we treat. So compounds are either single isomers, racemic, or non-racemic, in which case if they are non-racemic, then they are listed with a percent enantiomeric excess. And percent enantiomeric excess has a specific definition, which is a little different than you might think it is. So percent EE This can be calculated in a number of different ways. The amount of an antiomeric excess, that is not an antiomeric excess, can be calculated in a number of ways. The value is going to come out the same, but the way that we calculate it is expressed in a number of different ways. So the first way is using optical activity. So if we take optical activity and using observed optical activity, percent EE is defined as the absolute value of the observed rotation divided by the absolute value of the rotation of the pure enantiomer. And then we multiply this by 100. That equals percent EE. So that if we know that the pure enantiomer has a rotation of 100 degrees positive and the observed is 50 degrees, so just for an example, if we observe a 50 degree rotation and the pure is 100 degree rotation times 100, this is going to equal 50% enantiomeric excess. But what that literally means comes down to a different meaning. So we can use percents. Let's do it this way, using percents. So using percents, we say that percent enantiomeric excess is equal to the absolute value of the percent of R minus the percent of S. And using moles, let's put that one in, and then I'll show you what these all mean and kind of bring them all together. Using moles, what we get is percent EE is equal to the moles of R minus the moles of S, the absolute value of that, because these are always positive values, they're never negative values, divided by the moles of R plus the moles of S. And then we multiply that by 100. So basically what that means is that let's imagine that we have a mixture that is 75% R and 25% S. If we have a mixture, 75% R and 25% S, what is the interpretation? What is the enantiomeric excess? The enantiomeric excess, based on the percent EE formula, is going to equal the absolute value of 75% R minus 25% S, which is going to equal 50% enantiomeric excess. So when I have 50% enantiomeric excess, it doesn't mean that I have 50% of each, because that would be a racemic mixture. What it means is I have 50% more of one isomer than I have of the other. That's what it literally means. So an enantiomeric excess really is telling you how much of one isomer you have more than you have of the other isomer. And all of these ways of calculating it, whether it be by using optical activity or by using percents or by using moles, give you the exact same interpretation. So when you have a 5% enantiomeric excess, a 5% enantiomeric excess means that I have five, let's do it this way. That means that a 95% I said 5% net numeric excess. Let's do it that way. Ah, stop. I want the eraser. It won't go. All right. Crashed. Bring it back. I love how fast this application starts. That when it crashes, I can get it back up and running really quickly. Okay, now we're much better. So if I have 5% enantiomeric excess, and let's say that this is 5% of the positive isomer, the interpretation there is that I've got 55%, not 55, what do I need? If I got 5%, then I need 52.5, I think. So I have 52.5% R and minus 48.5% S, and that's equaling my 5% EE. So 5% EE is almost nothing. It is a very small 47.5. Yeah, Katrina, you're probably right. I'm trying to do this in my head. It's not easy to walk and chew gum and talk all at the same time. Thank you for keeping me honest. So that 50% EE, 5% EE, these are not large excesses in terms of enantiomeric excess. That usually when we want to have a medication and we want to produce something in single isomer, we're looking for 99% enantiomeric excess in order for the drug to be used in some way. Okay, Matthias, as a medic, we carried racemic epinephrine as a nebulizer treatment for croup. Does that mean that there was a different isomer of epinephrine used? Let me show you. Hang on a second. Epinephrine. Trying to get the structure. Got it. Okay. So what you did with epinephrine, this is the structure. It has two phenols, the aromatic ring, and then an alcohol that sits here that is only one stereocenter. So that's the epinephrine. And racemic means that it was a 50-50 mixture of both isomers, so that you are using a mixture that contains its enantiomer. And the epinephrine, then, the only active component of epinephrine would be the positive isomer, is this R or S? Does it tell me? Okay, quick review, we can figure it out. Let's figure out whether this is R or S. I was just going to cheat it, but highest priority is going to go to the alcohol. Second highest priority is going to go to the aromatic ring system. Third highest priority to the carbon. Hydrogen is the lowest priority. The hydrogen is already back, so I can just sweep it around this way. This is going counterclockwise. That is an S. This is S epinephrine. And I think it's E-P-E-N. It's no, E-P-I-N-E, epinephrine. Okay, this is the biologically active . This one is inactive, I believe. I'm guessing, but I think that's true. And racemic would mean that you have 0% EE. So this is 0% EE. This is racemic, which means that it's a 50-50 mix. And essentially, you're allowed to use the racemic epinephrine because the R isomer has been shown to be inactive and does not hurt anybody. The body just processes it and excretes it and does not use it in any sort of negative way. And so that's why you're able to use that racemic. But it has to be shown that a racemic mixture causes no harm before a medication can be used in a racemic form. So that's a great question as well. But that's what it meant that you used it racemic. It meant that it had the other isomer in it. It just wasn't utilized in the body. And so that's why it's allowed to be injected as a racemate. Okay.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah.
Sorry, just to follow up on that question, figured it'd just be easier to say it. Why would it be favorable? Do you know why it'd be favorable to use racemic versus just a normal solution of the just normal isomer of it?
Yeah. That's a great question too, because it's expensive and difficult to produce it in enantiomerically pure. So that's the whole next topic that's coming up, which is resolution. How do I separate these, or how do I synthesize just the single isomer? Remember that all these compounds have the same boiling point, the same polarity, the same melting point, same solubility. Everything is the same for these compounds, which means how do I separate them? Because every chemical reaction, when you do a chemical reaction that makes one isomer, it makes the other in equal amounts in most cases, in most types of chemical reactions. There are chemical reactions which are called, how do I want to say it? It's enantioselective. So chemical reactions can be enantioselective. Enantioselective. This is a chemical reaction that makes more of one isomer than the other. But those types of chemical reactions, while more common and are the types of things that I did in graduate school, those are one of the things that my research group worked on a lot, was enantioselective types of reactions. They are not easy to do and expensive. They require expensive reagents. And in order to resolve them, resolution is the process of isolating single isomers from a mixture, from a racemic mixture. And both of those processes are expensive. And so if the epinephrine can be shown to cause no harm in the isomer that is not the active isomer, then it is cheaper and more cost-effective to sell it as a racemate. So that's why they do it. If they can do it, they prefer to do it because it's so much cheaper for the medication in order to do it. To either do an enantioselective reaction or to do a resolution in order to make it single isomer and pure, that increases the cost exponentially of the drug in order to have to do that. So that's a great question, Matthias.
That's really cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Jason, can I ask a quick question about what you did when you did the percent enantiomeric excess?
Sure.
The one with 5%, since it's the absolute value, why did you assign those values specifically to R versus S?
I just did it.
Okay.
There was okay. No, yeah, it could have been 5% and it could have been an excess of S.
Okay, doesn't matter.
You have 5% enantiomeric excess of R. Okay, so that's why I did it that way. I just arbitrarily wrote it down.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, cool. Okay, I got Fisher projections that I didn't do, but I'm sort of into, I want to come back and do Fisher projections. How much time do I have? Oh, God, I had all these pages. No, but I'm at resolution, and I want to do resolution because we just talked about it, and it's really cool. So let's look at resolution. Since we're there, and that's a cool topic. And I'll save Fisher projections for another day. Okay, so chiral resolving agents, let's look at, instead of epinephrine, let's look at amphetamine and show how we can isolate amphetamine. So this is chiral resolution. This is one style of chiral resolution, but it serves to show how this works, which is really nice. So we're going to have a racemic mixture of amphetamine. Very much related to epinephrine structurally. So I think you'll see the structural similarities. And I'm going to use a wiggly bond to represent the stereoisomer. And I don't think we've ever used a wiggly bond before. So we have used a wedge bond, which means out of the plane. We have used a hash bond, which means back in the plane, in or out in that regard. Wiggly bond, this means both. It means racemic. Racemic at stereocenter. So that usually, if I want to write down that I have a racemic mixture, then what I would have to do is I would normally draw both isomers using the wedge bond and the hash bond. And these would be in 50-50 mixture of these two. And when I put those two together in equal amounts, so this is a 50-50 mixture, there's a couple of different ways I can write it. One way I can write it is to say that this equals the molecule drawn without the stereocenter, just as a wiggly bond, indicating both. And then it's also customary to put underneath it plus minus in brackets. The plus minus means that it does not rotate plane polarized light. The plus minus means that I have both the plus isomer and the minus isomer, and that both are present in equal quantities. That's what that means. And we could also write the word racemic. All three of these things are redundant. The wiggly bond means the same thing as the plus minus, means the same thing as writing the word racemic. So you can use all three or any one of those three to indicate racemic. Does racemic mixtures have depressed melting point or boiling points? No, Colin, they do not. Because the enantiomers have the same, have the exact same boiling point and melting points and polarity and all of those aspects. The racemate does not have a depressed boiling point or melting point. It is unchanged. And so no matter what percent EE, all the way from 0 to 100% EE, you will get the same boiling point for the mixture. That's a great question, Colin. And that's why we can't depend on boiling point. We have to depend on the plane polarized light in order to be able to tell us whether or not we have a mixture or not. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take this 50-50 mixture and we are going to treat it with a resolving agent. And the resolving agent that we are going to use is tartaric acid. Tartaric acid turns out to be really cheap. It is a byproduct of winemaking, and it comes enantiomerically pure. It comes enantiomerically pure because when you have a biological system like grapes that make chiral compounds, they almost always make them enantiomerically pure. That's one of the really cool things about natural products, is that natural products are inherently optically pure. They are inherently single isomer from almost all sources. Is that related to cream of tartar? Snickerdoodles. Cream of tartar is, yeah, I think it is. Although I can't remember, it's a salt of the tartaric acid. I have to think about that. I'm not exactly sure. But the tartaric acid, when you take, if you've ever had red wine and you take the cork out of the red wine and there's all those crystals, those red crystals on the bottom of the cork, if you've ever seen that, those crystals are tartaric acid. The tartaric acid is single isomer and pure and cheap as just a byproduct of winemaking that comes in the grapes. And so tartaric acid is a great resolving agent, especially for these types of epinephrine, amphetamine, all of these different amine type compounds is a great resolving agent because it's a carboxylic acid. And so what we're going to do is we're going to get an acid-base reaction taking place. So this is 2R, 3R, and this is the plus isomer of tartaric acid. This is the natural isomer of tartaric acid. And what that does is it makes two salts so that as we react with the amphetamine here, we're going to wind up making two salts. And the two salts that we're going to make is we're going to get the minus enantiomer or the, what is this? This is the, did I put names on these? I did not. Let's put names on them really quick. The first one here is the S, and this is the plus amphetamine. And the other one is the R minus amphetamine. That part's going to be sort of important. So what we're getting here, let's see, we put the S plus first. So let's do the S plus first because it's on this side. The amine winds up taking the proton from the tartaric acid such that I get the anion and the cation, and this becomes a salt. So this is now a salt complex. And as a salt complex, remember that I'm dealing with the S plus amphetamine, and I am dealing with the 2R, 3R tartaric acid. So the salt complex that I have made is the S plus the 2R, 3R. And this is now a complex bound together. And the other salt complex that I make is from the R minus isomer and the tartaric acid likewise makes the salt. And this salt complex is now 2R, 3R. So this is the R plus the 2R, 3R. And that is the complex. And just to highlight this, here's our S. And then my R's, let's do R's in blue. So 2R, 3R. Right? And here's my 2R, my 3R, 2R, 3R, and this is an R. Okay. What is the relationship between the salts? Why isn't the plus in parentheses? The plus is not, I wasn't trying to, I was saying and. The plus was an and. It's not, I'm not using, we're getting mixed up between signs of rotation versus an and symbol in the complex. That's what was going on there. So I wasn't trying to make that a plus as in rotation. I was trying to make that a plus as in and. So what I want to know is what is the relationship between these two salts? Basically, I'm asking, are they enantiomers or diastereomers? Can you guys tell me? Diastereomers. Francisco's got it. That they are diastereomeric salts. So these are diastereomeric salts. And the thing about diastereomeric salts is they have different solubilities, so that one of these salts remains aqueous and one of these salts precipitates out and becomes a solid. And because of that, you can filter it out. And once you filter it out, you have separated the two compounds. Nicole, is that supposed to be an NH3 or an NH2 group at the end of the S? This is an NH3 at that one. And there were twos before. It's NH3 in the salt place. Did I get it, Nicole? Do you see what I'm doing there? I just didn't have the charge on it, which may have made that more challenging. I think I answered Nicole's question. Okay, cool. All right, so while enantiomers are identical compounds, have the same boiling points, melting points, have the same solubilities, everything is the same for enantiomers. Diastereomers are different compounds, and diastereomers have different physical properties. That allows one of these to be more soluble than the other. It allows one to precipitate out and then to literally filter out the other one. And then once we filter them out, then we do what's called freebasing. Then what we do is we go through and we actually do an acid-base extraction and take the amine back to its neutral component, extract it, rotovap it down, and isolate it. And we have separated out the compounds by using the physical properties of diastereomers to separate them out. So this is one way of doing a resolution, is through resolution by using another enantiomerically pure chiral compound. Okay, so that's a resolution example. So some of the other things that I wanted to go into was, let's see, I got a couple of minutes. This goes back to a question that Francisco had on the previous lecture. And this is a really good spot to hit it real quick as the last little thing to finish up on, as a way to finish up. And then I'll go back and I'll hit some other forms of representation in the next lecture, but symbols used. So these are stereochemical symbols. And meanings. So the first one that we used was plus and minus, and these are rotations of plane polarized light. We have D and L, and these are superscript, or these are italicized D and L, where D stands for dextrorotatory, which is meaning that this is a positive rotation, and levorotatory, which is meaning negative rotation. So the small d and the lowercase l are dextrorotatory, levorotatory. They're telling you the same thing. They're rotations of plane polarized light. That's what those symbols mean. Then we had R and S. R and S are configurations based on Kahn-Engel-Prelog rules. And then we have a small cap D and a small cap L. So these are small caps, not big caps. The small cap D and L is a configuration assignment used in a Fisher projection used for sugars and amino acids. And what they mean is that in a Fisher projection, which we were going to do, it was set up earlier and I skipped over it, but in a Fisher projection, and we'll go through this next time, what it does is it looks at the last chiral center. So each one of these would be chiral centers. And we'll talk more about how these are drawn and set up. When the last highest priority group is on the right, the last group, then this is called a D. And if that last group is on the left in the sugar or the amino acid, then this is called an L. It doesn't tell you about the configurations of any of the other centers. So last group on left equals L. So we have plus minus, lowercase d, lowercase l. Those are all talking about rotational plane polarized light. So we can put sort of a line through here that those two are the same. R and S are man-made configurations that tell us what the stereocenter is configured as. D and L are less useful. They tell you only about the last stereocenter. All the other stereocenters need to be memorized based on the name. So that's where that little D and L come from. And they're used in sugars and amino acids such that you have D sugars and L amino acids, and they tell you just about where that last chiral carbon is and the orientation of the last chiral carbon. Okay, Colin, you had a question. Wait, so in salt, from these, are there diastereomers even though their cations are enantiomers? Colin, that's going back up to here. In a salt, cations, the cations, the salts are diastereomers, even though the cations are enantiomers. Yes, the cationic portion of the salt, if we looked at the cations themselves would be said to be enantiomers. But the salt complex that forms is an actual diastereomer. So when we form a salt, if we think about this precipitating out as a solid, which is happening here, that's not what I wanted. I want this tool, partial. That gives me a pointer. Okay, so now I got a pointer. If I'm looking over here and I'm looking at this material as a solid, the and in there, the square brackets around it are really indicating that what I'm doing is precipitating that out. And it's precipitating out as a solid, and the two salts are are diastereomeric together, or diastereomeric in relationship to each other, which gives them different physical properties. So yes, we could point to parts of the salt and say parts of the salt are enantiomers, but the others are diastereomers. Katrina, are we pushing back the midterm that's scheduled for Monday? Yeah, that midterm is not happening Monday. Absolutely, that is not gonna happen. So we'll push that back, and I'll give you a harder deadline on that when we get a little bit farther and I can project out where it is we're going to be. I need to look and see how fast we're actually moving in these lectures and give you an idea of when I think that midterm is going to be. But it is definitely not happening on Monday. All right. Any other questions I can answer for you guys? As we're up against the 12:30 deadline, and I've been talking long enough, and this is going to be a long enough video. So if you got any questions, can we go over more of the co-op and office hours? Absolutely, Finn. Join me in office hours and I'll sit down and I'll go over more of the co-op if you want, for sure. All right, and I'll put out a little email saying when office hours start up, and we'll do them at the right time at 1:30, but I'll just send out a link so everybody can find it easier. And yeah, welcome to join me in office hours anytime, and I will do more of that co-op as much as you want.
Thank you, Jason.
Hey, you're welcome, Elias. You guys take care. Have a good day, and I'll see the afternoon group in afternoon lab.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
Hi, Jason.
Yes.
Actually, I just went back to my note, and I just have a really quick question. I just don't know where the hexane comes from.
Hexane was back when we were doing optical rotations, and the hexane was the solvent that was used to dilute the limonene. So when we say 100 milliliters and 12.3 grams, what I'm saying there, if you're watching the screen where I'm at now, is that this is 100 milliliters of solution. So this is the solution made from hexane.
Oh, okay, I got it. Yeah, that's
it. And that the 12.3 grams is the limonene that is dissolved in it.
Okay, got it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good job with the question there.
Okay, so I'll see. Oh, so are you going to have office hour today for the co-op?
Yeah, 1:30.
1:30. Okay, I'll see you at 1:30. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks, Anne.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Colin, are you hanging out to see what's going to happen at the end here? Or do you have a question that you want to ask? Roxana, you had questions, or are you guys just hanging out at the end? Or I'm going to assume that you guys maybe walked away and didn't close it out. So I'm going to go ahead and close out in the meeting, and I will see you guys later this afternoon.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.